This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Sex worker, and yes, it does. In those biblical sense, I am beyond the pretend. Fang hooker, sex worker, wench, thou met her mind. Listen up close while I take it backwards. Oh, okay, because the gal is in me, which I want. I'm not a prostitute. Sex workers, but I can give you what you want. Sex worker, damn it. Go
get some. You've tuned in to the Vixen Hour. Sex workers setting the record straight on Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9. Red Umbrella Radio.
That's right, you have tuned into the Vixen Hour. The Vixen Hour is your weekly radio show that explores life, issues and the world from a sex worker's perspective. This is your opportunity to challenge the stereotypes and prejudice that you may have about sex work and hear from the actual voices of sex workers ourselves. We are out loud and proud. This is the only radio show in Australia that is broadcast to your radios every week and available online all the time. Turn it up.
All discussions presented on Vixen Hour are made in the interest of community information and are not intended to induce any individual to seek employment in the sex industry. For more information in this area, we recommend individuals to get in contact with their local sex work organisation. The Vixen Hour. Everyone has an opinion about sex work. Make yours an informed one.
Joy 94.9.
That's right, you have tuned in here to the Vixen Hour. And tonight we are bringing you a very special show. We spoke earlier in the week with the fabulous Dr. Brooke Magnanti. Now, Dr. Brooke Magnanti is a research scientist. She is also somebody who jumped onto the blogosphere very early on back in 2003 and started blogging as Belle de Jour, writing the blog The Secret Diary of a London Call Girl. That then later became a novel and that achieved quite a cult following, which then was later turned into a TV show starring the fabulous Billy Piper. We did get to speak to her last week, and I thought tonight we would play that interview. If at any point you'd like to interact with the program, you can do so by texting in on 0427 Joy949 or sending us an email on air at joy.org.au. Let's go to that interview now. We'll start off with a few sound bites from the TV show Secret Diary of a Call Girl, and we'll hear from Brooke straight after that. Here we go.
Joy.
Joy.
94.9.
I love London. I love its rudeness, its lack of community, its impatience. I even love its weather. But most of all, I love the anonymity. The first thing you should know about me is that I'm a whore. In a world of children in bikinis and grandmothers in fuck me boots, the surest way to tell a prostitute is to look for the woman in the designer suit. Locate the lifts. Ride past reception. Look like you know where you're going. Walk quickly. Don't attract too much attention. Be fabulous but forgettable. You should also know that this isn't the real me. Escort, hooker, prostitute, whore, I don't mind what you call me, that's just semantics. There are as many different kinds of working girls as there are kinds of people, so you can't generalise. But I can tell you about me. I should say up front that I wasn't abused by a relative, I've got no children to support, and I've never been addicted to anything. Except for maybe the fourth season of The West Wing, but, you know. I'm very high class. Which means I charge by the hour, and I charge a lot. So why do I do it? Well, I love sex, and I love money. And I know you don't believe I enjoy the sex, but I do. Plus, I'm fundamentally lazy. What I really like is being my own boss. Well, pretty much my own boss. Obviously, I have an agent. She bets on my clients.
Two lovely new gentlemen for you today.
Okay.
An out call for this evening and an in call this afternoon.
When? 2 o'clock.
It's 1:30 now.
Is it?
Yes. You know I need at least an hour's notice.
Well, shit, shower and shave, sweetheart. He's on his way over now.
I have certain rules. Rule one, keep life and job separate. Personal, work. Private, professional. Hannah, Belle, and never the twain shall meet. Rule number two, stay in control. They sit down, I stand up, get the money first. Yeah, I'll call after. No problem. All right, bye. Rule three, safety. Always check in with the agency. So if I say no problemo instead of no problem, there's a problem. Everything you need's in here. Rule four, hygiene. Mine and his. I always use men's deodorant. I never wear perfume. A professional never lets her client leave smelling of woman. Convince them that you're wet and you're halfway there. Goes without saying. And last, but definitely not least, work out what the client wants as fast as you can and give it to him. Of conversation in the escort-client relationship, number one. So, Ash, global warming. Will it inevitably lead to an apocalypse? Keep it light. Tell me, can a revitalised Tory party ever really win over the Northern vote? No politics. And perhaps the most important of all, does your wife know you'd like to take it up for that? No inflammatory topics. Sometimes it's not the youngest or the richest clients you want, or the ones you have most in common with. For me, the perfect partner is one where I never have to be myself.
Joy 94.9.
You're on the Vixen Hour here on Joy 94.9. You're with Christian, and I'm joined by the fabulous Dr. Brooke Magnanti. Hello, Brooke.
Hello, Christian. How are you?
I'm good. So, as many people would know, Brooke is a research scientist, a blogger, a writer, famously putting together, back in the early days of blogging, Belle du Jour, The Diary of a London Call Girl, which was later turned into a book. And can I just say, a source of inspiration for many sex workers around the world who were struggling to find actual sex worker voices that they could relate to. So in a way, I mean, we try to do that here at the Vixen Hour, bring out the voices of actual sex workers, but you kind of did it very early on.
Oh, I mean, that's really kind. I though, in my turn, have to give props to writers like Tracy Kwan, because I remember reading her writing before blogging, but she was writing for a website called Nerve.com. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it was a fictional account of when she had been a call girl. But it still struck me just being able to write honestly about what a lot of people perceived to be such a prurient and difficult topic. Mm. And I think that's something that a lot of people connected to when blogging started to hit big, was getting those realistic details of people's lives and a way of kind of looking in on stuff you wouldn't have access to otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. And now we've just seen an explosion of sex workers getting online, writing blogs. We're hearing a lot more of sex workers' perspectives. And certainly through social media, sex workers have been able to sort of connect with each other in a very real way to sort of and express solidarity. But I imagine back in 2003, there may have not have been a lot of that. I was wondering, was it a very lonely activity to do, to take part in?
I mean, it could be. There were some other people blogging, although they were in other areas of sex work, so like Tasty Trixie, who ran a home porn site, and Mistress Matisse, who's a dominatrix, and they were both based in the States, and I used to blog and sort of chat with them. And then also, this is back when Diablo Cody was still a stripper,
right,
and she was blogging under her work name and before her real identity came out. I use real, you know, advisedly, yeah, because, of course, it's all real.
Of course.
But, you know. And then there were other sex workers in London who, other escorts, but their blogs were mostly advertising.
Yeah.
So you could tell they were presenting the persona that we all present when we're at work, mm-hmm, and not really going too much into the other bits and pieces of their lives, because obviously, I think everybody in any job, you separate your work life from your personal life all the time.
Sure.
So it was a way to kind of take the personal part of my life and put that forward as well. But yeah, it was just a way to take my personal life and put that forward as well in a way that wasn't connected with my escorting identity.
Sure. Speaking of identities, you're quite often referred to interchangeably as either Belle de Jour or Dr. Brooke Magnanti. I kind of want to call you Dr. de Jour.
I love that. That's great.
But I think that might conjure up a few other different images that it's not supposed to. Do you see that as a problem? Do you have a preference? How do you feel about that identity now?
I mean, some people do ask me, you know, do you have a problem with still being referred to that way? And I write for The Telegraph now in the UK, so it's a rather different paper to The Telegraph here, although very right-wing.
And, yeah, yeah.
and my byline is Dr. Brooke Magnanti, formerly known as Belle de Jour. And that was actually something I suggested to them because, uh-huh, of course, whenever you're being exposed to a new readership, you kind of have to keep introducing yourself all the time.
Right.
And that was really the surprise for me. I thought when everything happened back in 2009 and people knew that I was a child health researcher and knew my real name and where I lived and all of these little details, I thought that it would just happen the once and it would be over with. But actually, you have to kind of give people a potted life story over and over and over again because they'll find out anyway. So I kind of am in the position now of trying to get people the information first before, sure, they find out other ways.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Now, here on the Vixen Hour, whenever we do have a new guest, a new sex worker on the show, we do ask them, well, what does sex work mean to you? Sort of identifying that it can be quite problematic to apply one definition to everybody. And we sort of try to explore the diversity of how sex workers themselves define sex work. So, Dr. Brooke Magnanti, what does sex work mean to you?
I suppose if I had to define it or define a sex worker, mm-hmm, I would say that it is somebody who profits directly from their own sexual labor in some way. So I would call porn actresses sex workers, mm-hmm, and I would call porn directors not sex workers. And of course, that's a problem because there's so many people who blur those lines. You,
yeah,
know,
right,
you think about people like Furry Girl, Madison Young, people who are on both, mm-hmm, sides of the camera constantly.
Yeah.
But I think that's all, you know, that's always been the case when it comes to work. And you can take on a role for a few weeks or for a particular project. But I do think if the majority of what you do is profiting from your own sexual labor, then you're a sex worker.
Absolutely.
So whether that is phone sex, cam sex, all of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, has that understanding of sex work, was that something that you had prior to starting or was it quite different?
It's always really been there because it kind of seems obvious to me when you look at it from a kind of a labor point of view, really, if you frame sex work as work and all of sex workers' rights as being just labor rights generally, that seems fairly straightforward. And obviously, back in the UK, there have been loads of conflicts because people have such different definitions.
Yeah.
And when it comes to joining unions and who can join a union, who can't join a union,
mm-hmm,
who do people want in, who do people want out. But I think that that's actually something that labor organizing has been facing since,
yeah,
the very start.
Oh, absolutely. Speaking of organizations, were you somebody who, I guess, when I see you interviewed, you have this fierce advocacy on behalf of sex worker rights and sex worker issues. Coming out, being such a publicly known sex worker, does the role of advocate, do you feel like we have a, like people who are publicly out as sex workers have a responsibility to speak up about those issues, to be...
Yeah, I do, but it can be in so many different ways. I mean, mm-hmm. I would never suggest that anybody has a responsibility, for example, to do the kind of media engagements that I do, in part because the blowback from some of those things can be so horrible that people who are prepared to put themselves forward might not be prepared mm-hmm. for the horrible comments that you get and the trolling. But even if advocacy just means in small ways, if that just means talking to your taxi driver, mm-hmm. as I often do when they ask me, if they pick me up from, you know, a radio station somewhere and they ask, oh, what have you been doing? I don't shy away from it. I tell them because I think to myself, well, this is somebody I'm only going to see for 5 minutes of my life ever. So if they judge me harshly, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But also just being open in small ways with friends and family. And really making that connection for people. I mean, I sat down and tried to make a back-of-the-envelope calculation recently of how many current and ex-sex workers there are in Britain. We've got an okay estimate that at any time it's about 80,000 are current.
Yeah.
But if you extrapolate that to someone's entire working lives, as if this is an epidemiology question, you actually turn up with close to 1 million people living in Britain who have at some point been involved as workers in the sex industry.
Absolutely.
And if people knew that, if people knew, you know, you are shopping in Tesco with sex workers or ex-sex workers, I really do think it would change people's minds.
Sure. I absolutely believe that everybody knows a sex worker. It's just that the level of stigma is so high that, you know, disclosure rarely happens. I mean, we have our own radio show. That's how we do advocacy. We bump it up a few levels.
Which is fantastic because, of course, I mean, radio was the blogging of its day. You know, the wonderful thing about blogging is that anybody can access it. Even if you don't own a computer, you can go into a library, you can sign up for a blog for free, and you could be blogging. I mean, that is how accessible it is. And in a very important way throughout the 20th century, and now, you know, with webcasting, radio is a kind of very similar sort of technology that the cost of entry is relatively low compared to, say, being on television.
Sure.
And it always surprises me. I mean, I'll be going on Q&A later on today. So.
Oh, the very best of luck, by the way.
But I was really surprised when somebody told me, do you know, I think this will be the first time that a sex worker or ex-sex worker who is known to be an ex-sex worker will be on this incredibly high-profile show that gets five people in every single week. And I think myself, that amazes me. But the barrier to participation in that kind of thing, there is a physical cost. There's also an emotional cost.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's just so much better, I think, for people to sort of dip your toes in with blogging, radio, and literally get your voice out there.
I think a lot of people, like I said, were very inspired, very, very enthralled by your blog and felt like they got to know you that way. But I think what's quite unique about you is you seem to also be this academic powerhouse. Like the way that you have challenged a lot of those difficult interviews when people just throw study after study after study to you, you process it and you engage with it in quite a unique way that I guess other activists or advocates just aren't able to. It's one of the reasons I've fallen in love with you on screen. Sorry, that was very bashfully admitting that. Do you see, I guess, the ability to engage with academics as a really important thing? Because one of the interesting things that, like, you've come out and said is that you're not a feminist. Do you feel like feminism is sort of a space that has been dominated by academics, so much so that, you know, people who are traditionally sidelined by feminism, so whether they're people of colour or sex workers, do sort of have to question whether they identify as a feminist or not?
Yeah.
How do you sort of respond to that?
No, I completely agree, because I think it's taken for granted that if you are a woman of a certain kind, you must be a feminist. And I think I did always take that for granted. I was certainly raised to be a feminist. My mother is a feminist. I never questioned whether or not I was a feminist until all these academic feminists and what I would call your kind of blue stocking second wave feminists of the UK media, the people like Julie Bindle and Zoe Williams and Tanya Gold, all turn around and say, you specifically, you cannot be a feminist. You cannot be part of our club.
Yeah, you have let the team down.
I've let the team down massively. But to be honest, I was letting the team down from day one, long before I was a sex worker.
Yeah.
Just by, being a woman in science and all of these kinds of things. And I thought to myself, well, I'm a woman and I'm going to be a woman until I die. That my membership of that group is, fully paid up. I'm going to be identified as an ex-sex worker until I die. Do I really need to be fighting for feminism to include me and to be sort of jumping up and down and saying, love me, accept me? There's so much other work to be done as a woman and as an ex-sex worker that I feel that is really enough to be getting on with.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Now, the story of your coming out, or your identity being revealed, as I understand it, there was, you felt like a newspaper was following you, had cottoned on to your real identity, and I guess there was a threat of them outing you?
Yeah, well, it was, I can say it was the Mail on Sunday, which is, when you think about the feral British press, they are the worst of the worst, partly because they have the most money. If they get the even slightest whiff of a story, they can chase it all over the world. And I had some people email me, and a couple of things that happened that suggested that it was the Mail who had found me, which included a Mail reporter, M-A-I-L reporter, breaking into my office at the hospital, having to be removed by the police. And it was at that point I thought to myself, they are just going to follow me until they figure it out, because you can try to stonewall them.
Yeah.
I thought, no, this is something they think is front page. They're going to just harass me forever.
Yeah.
So I took a couple of weeks to think about it, because it was such a big thing. There was a part of me that had always been expecting that to happen, but of course I got no say in the timing whatsoever. And a funny sort of little side story to that is, I decided I was going to talk to a rival paper, to the Times. I had this interview with India Knight, who had been one of the people who, when I started blogging, saying, oh, this cannot possibly be written by a woman. So I decided it was very important to reveal myself to somebody who had been a skeptic.
Right.
And I had this interview with her, and then I had a few days before it was going to be published in which to let everybody know that this was coming. And at the same time, it's very strange, there's a branch of my family who live down in Ecuador. One of my cousins had been kidnapped and was being held for $1 million ransom, just chained to a tree in the middle of the rainforest. So all of this is going on. My family are already freaking out about one enormous, very important thing that's going on. And I'm sitting there going, oh my goodness, I don't want to bother them with this. I don't want to, just the timing from my point of view could not have been worse.
That's quite interesting. We just had recently had an episode of the Vixen Hour focusing on coming out, and a couple of the participants talked about the importance of timing and how things like, major family tragedies or events just do not wait. So.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like, I had no choice, so I'm having this conversation where my mother is saying, okay, well, the kidnappers have actually been talked down. Do you have anything in your savings? We're putting everything together, the embassy now, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, oh, you know what? By the way, some reporters might turn up. There's going to be some stuff in the papers here. Was an escort. Really sorry. Bye.
Wow. Oh, dear.
I mean, my mother was a rock. She had cars chasing her down the street. She had reporters trying to get into her house. She had them putting their cards under her door and just offering her more and more and more money for a photo of me as a child.
Wow.
Which was just ridiculous. I mean, it was so over the top.
Yeah.
It was such, for me, it was a very big deal, obviously.
Yeah.
Anybody's story like that is always a big deal to them. In terms of what is important news that newspapers should be,
should be reporting,
I honestly don't see how this rates.
Well, do you think, had you not been sort of stalked by the Mail, would you have ever come out?
I really didn't want to. And actually, it's funny to think about it now, because I actually think that it's been such a unbalanced positive experience for me. You know, just to be honest with my friends and family about the issues and to not feel like I was hiding things from them. So it's been such a positive experience, but yet I did not intend to come out. I used to joke with people, I'm going to come out as a retirement plan. When I'm 65 and I need to get one book and just cash in on this, that's when it's going to happen.
Fantastic.
Things got speeded up just a teeny tiny bit.
Uh-huh. Well, when I came out to my mum, it was because I'd built my sort of public profile kind of up to the point where I was going to run in an election.
Oh, right.
And I sort of thought, it's really important to run as a sex worker, just because of, increasing public visibility of sex workers and, you know, recognizing them as part of the community. So I sat her down to tell her that because I had just been interviewed by a newspaper and I really didn't want her to find out via newspaper. So it was like, okay, this is the opportunity to answer all of the questions and get it right in your head. So if other family members read the newspaper and they come to you, you're sort of equipped and prepared to be able to engage with that kind of stuff. I'm wondering what your family's reaction was. I know it was a very quick conversation and the circumstances perhaps weren't as ideal, but how has the reception been from sort of family and friends?
For the most part, my family have been pretty good about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's well known that I'm estranged from my father. He and I hadn't spoken for 5 years before all of this happened back in 2009. Mm-hmm. And by that point, he and I hadn't spoken for 5 years. And I tried to get in contact with him prior to everything coming out in the papers. And I wasn't able to, and the papers got to him first, which was really unfortunate. He, after my parents divorced, I wrote about it in my second book. Mm-hmm. They divorced when I was in my 20s. And then he sort of spiraled down into drug addiction, and we kind of fell out over, basically the drugs became the most important thing in his life. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was for two consecutive weekend splashed across the mail on Sunday, who of course had lost the story of revealing me, felt they had to claw back what they could with my father is a crack addict who, you know, goes with streetwalkers, etc., etc., etc. Just absolutely sordid, seedy stuff, which I knew that they would do. They couldn't resist it. And it was hilarious, though, sort of going, maybe this is what made her do it. And
yeah.
Thinking, yeah, something
of course.
That happened when I was 27 was such a formative experience. But the funny thing about it was just I felt bad that he felt bad.
Yeah.
Because the sort of tone of the story was that he felt guilty. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, you know, whatever it is he's feeling, I don't want him to feel guilty. I just want him to reprioritize his life a bit, however that works best for him. And it was something that I really struggled with because I'm not sure that it would have gone much differently, though, if I had been able to talk to him beforehand, to be honest.
Wow. Thank you for sharing.
It's one of those things because I think, you know, I've got to give both sides of it, really, because it's been a net positive experience for me. And I think as well, people see that, you know, I tweet and I blog still and write books and all this, and they see what is a very polished side of the story and go, oh, well, it hasn't affected her at all. And, you know, I hope that being visible encourages more people to be visible, but I also don't want to make it sound like it's not difficult, because it definitely is.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, like I'm very easily out, I think. I'm just unapologetic about it. And I think when people see that, the wanting to criticize it and find something wrong just goes absolutely
out. But I think that's brilliant, though, because the more unapologetic you are, the less they have about it. If somebody knocks on your door and says, oh, I've heard X, Y, Z about you, you go, oh, yeah, that's right, you heard that, good, well done. Takes the wind right out of their sail.
And Belle certainly received a lot of that criticism, and it's interesting to see a lot of that sort of wind back as soon as she's a real person and you came out and your identity was revealed.
Oh, but they go for different things now. Totally. I mean, the thing that shocked me was there was one writer whom I shall not name in mm-hmm. UK media who about a year later wrote some article making reference to the fact that I've got quite a lot of scars on my skin because I had acne when I was a teenager. And it's the sort of thing that really shows up on television. In person, it's fairly subtle, but on television, mm-hmm. with the lights, it's like, wah,
there it is.
There it is. You know,
adding the 10 pounds to
the
scar.
it's the 10 pounds of scars. but you know, it's one of those things I got over a long time ago, and, mm-hmm. and obviously it predated sex work. You mm-hmm. know, it's how you react is how people will see you. And then some other supposedly feminist writer, again, was tweeting about how not good looking I supposedly was. And, and I just thought to myself, ladies, you're the ones who are letting the side down.
Yeah.
I mean, for goodness sake.
Absolutely.
You know, but it was catty mm-hmm. school stuff. It's, mm-hmm. it's the kind of thing that you get when you're a teenager and you think, if that's the best they've got, I can deal with that.
It's their secret little way of saying, look, we've got nothing on you.
Yeah, we just don't like you. We think you're icky.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ Community Radio Station, Joy 94.9.
I wanted to ask about the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to say something that is quite often said to publicly out sex workers who particularly write and share their story a lot, and say that it was extraordinarily brave of you to do that. And I mean, it screened on primetime television here in Australia on a mainstream television channel. But the reason I wanted to say that it was a brave thing to do, because sex worker writers get that a lot, and we've spoken to a number of them who have said that. What I wanted to sort of say was brave was you gave your story to somebody else to make the TV show.
Mm, yeah.
Did you sort of watch the TV show thinking, oh, I didn't want it to be like that? What was your reaction to?
Well, it's funny because I was actually pretty happy with it in the end because it had made so many changes. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, first off, because I was anonymous when I wrote the books, mm-hmm. that was never a full picture of my life. I couldn't really talk about the science part of my life, mm-hmm. for example. So I knew that any television show was necessarily going to be an adaptation of an adaptation, as it were.
Right.
You know, a very narrow slice of what was already a narrow slice.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of agreed early on because they only bought the rights to the first book, and mm-hmm. then there were several more Belle de Jour books after that Belle was really going to evolve on the television show differently
mm-hmm.
from the books. And I was perfectly fine with that because I think that if you're sitting there trying to get every single little thing in an adaptation right, you'll drive yourself crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so they took some liberties. Obviously, I never did in-call when I was working, for example. I only ever did out-call. I was in a relationship for mm-hmm. most of the time when I was escorting, and various little bits and pieces like that. I think in the show as well, she was a native Londoner who hadn't come from somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
Whereas being new to London was very much part of my story.
Sure.
So those changes, though, for me, just allowed them to open it up a bit. And, you know, they consulted with me, but they also consulted with a lot of other sex workers.
Right.
So it was much more of an amalgamation mm-hmm. of various people's stories, which I was pretty happy about, actually, because it really shouldn't be just me.
Yeah.
You know, no one person is the story mm-hmm. of sex work and sex workers. So it should just be about as many voices out there as possible.
Absolutely, which is why we do bring in a new sex worker here on the Vixen Hour every week. I did want to ask about the book, and as in Sex Myths. It goes through such a diverse range of material, but it is always focused on sex. What do you see as... There's always this moral panic and paranoia around sex. People just don't get, and people are a lot more conservative than they'd like to admit, which is, I guess, why a lot of, you know, there's this social neuroses that sort of cause a lot of those myths that you talk about in the book to happen. Mm-hmm. What do you see as sort of, I guess, the state of the social conceptualization of sexuality, and why is the paranoia there, do you think?
I do think it's one of these things that's really difficult to pin down, but what I've noticed is on various issues. Things will ebb and flow. You know, we mm-hmm. talk about sex worker rights or gay rights or, you know, any of a host of other issues where things have come and gone. Things will improve, then they'll get worse, then they'll improve again. Mm-hmm. And this has happened over history and yeah. throughout societies all over the world. Mm-hmm. And I do think there's something about people being anxious about mm-hmm. things that make these things flare up again, that make the hate and the worry and the moral panic mm-hmm. flare up again. It's almost like people are feeling so uncertain about the economy. All of a sudden, they're worried about migrants. Mm-hmm. They're worried about sex. They're worried about all of these things that we really have very, very little control over. But it's almost like it's a proxy for a general, oh, will I and my family still be okay in the future? And of course, when we talk about sex work, there's so many migration issues tied mm-hmm. up in that. I mean, one thing that often gets erased from my own story is that I was very much in a position of being a migrant in Britain, 5,000 miles from home.
Yeah, right.
No money, no recourse to public funds, so no mm-hmm. way to go on the dole or have access to social housing, and as well limited to only being able to work 15 hours a week by my visa.
Yeah.
And it was that kind of situation. It's, you know, things feel really close to the bone then.
Yeah. It's interesting in Australia, because we have such a heightened consciousness of that issue, very rarely do we see the term migrant sex worker used, unless it's by actual sex worker advocates. Mm. Quite often they will use the term trafficked victims in Australia. But those issues, the ones that you've just identified, are sort of experienced by all migrants, regardless of, I guess, their race or ethnicity or country of origin when coming to a foreign country.
Yeah, absolutely. And while a significant percentage of migrants will end up in sex work, other migrants will end up in agricultural jobs, other migrants will end up in other areas of the service economy. And these are places where people can be exploited as well. But for some mm-hmm. reason, no one's really concerned about exploitation happening, mm-hmm. you know, on farms.
Yeah,
in cannabis
textiles.
Farms.
Yeah.
And then yeah. it's terrible and these people all must be deported. But it really does seem to be just a lot of anxiety and it's almost kind of a small island feeling that you get in Britain right now, because everything in the papers is just migration this and
yeah.
oh, now the Bulgarians and the Romanians are coming, so we've got this perfect storm of people who will take the plumbing jobs, the farming jobs, and they'll go into sex work because
yeah.
of course all of the Eastern Europeans are just, it's just all about the sex.
Oh, of course.
it's just these horrible xenophobic stereotypes that get played over and over.
Yeah.
I do hope that it will die down.
Yeah. And quite often, we experience it in our region here, and it is sort of a racism and classism sort of blended together, where sort of people from, you know, poorer neighboring countries. So, you know, in here, Southeast Asia, there's this idea that, you know, people coming from China or Thailand or Korea would be exploited sex workers. Mm-hmm. Whereas quite often when you actually speak to them, you know, these are people who've done sex work in their own country. They're just trying to find a way to migrate to work.
Yeah, absolutely. And as well, I think that people who themselves have never imagined themselves as sex workers find it so difficult to imagine doing this as a job. But I find it equally difficult to imagine being a teacher. That's a job I know I could never do.
Absolutely.
You know, but I don't go up to teachers and go, what is wrong with you? What happened when you were a child that made you do this?
Are you really that desperate? How do you see sex work in the UK? Like the state of sex, there's a number of issues. So there's there's a number of reforms that are being looked at in Scotland, for example.
Yeah, Scotland, Northern Ireland, mm-hmm. Over in Republic of Ireland as well. And there's some suggestion that it might come to the table in England and Wales.
Yeah.
I do think people are going to be watching mm-hmm. Very closely what happens in Ireland and what happens in Scotland. I'm betting on it not going through in Scotland. I've got to say, it's failed once before, mm-hmm. very, very recently, and I think as well the opposition to this idea of bringing in a kind of Swedish model type of thing
yeah.
Has been you know, sex workers have been much more organized about getting voices out there, talking mm-hmm. to the media, responding to consultations this time around. But I can't help but think that Ireland's going to go the other way.
Yeah.
It was really worrying to see the public hearings that they were webcasting. Mm-hmm. And you had the Irish TDs, which is their MPs, mm-hmm. saying, oh, well, we went over to Sweden. We saw how they did it. We spoke to all the stakeholders on the issue. And then it was like, who are all the stakeholders? The police and the government. Well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Somebody might be missing from your all the stakeholders.
Yeah, which is such a shame because in Sweden, sex workers are actually quite organized. And,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. They've been very vocal and very good about using social media and especially YouTube.
Absolutely.
To get the message out there and for it to be so completely ignored. I mean, the Irish politicians could have stayed at home and looked at YouTube mm-hmm. and had a better idea of how the real stakeholders, the people who are actually affected by this legislation,
yeah.
were feeling about it.
Absolutely. Well, Brooke Magnanti, it has been absolutely fabulous to chat to you.
Oh, it's been brilliant talking to you.
You're listening to The Vixen Hour here on Joy 94.9.
Dr. Brooke Magnanti, formerly known as Belle du Jour, and you're listening to The Vixen Hour on Joy 94.9.
That's right. You have been listening to The Vixen Hour on Joy 94.9, listening to our talk with the fabulous Dr. Brooke Magnanti, also known as Belle du Jour, who wrote The Secret Diary of a London Call Girl, later turned into a novel, later turned into a hit TV show that you could probably buy at all your good DVD retailers. If you'd like to keep up with Dr. Magnanti's writing, you can visit her blog, The Sex Myth, which is based spin-off from her book, and that is at sexonomics-uk.blogspot.com.au. We'll probably post a link to that on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/sexworkerradio. If you want to stay connected to The Vixen Hour, you can follow us on Twitter as well at Vixen Hour. What a fabulous show. What an amazing, amazing guest. And I know an absolute inspiration to many sex workers, including myself. But next week on The Vixen Hour, we'll be talking about the topic of sex work and mental health. That's going to be a really big, important topic, and there'll be lots to talk about. As I said, you can stay connected to us on Facebook and Twitter, and we would love to hear from you. You've been listening to The Vixen Hour here on Joy 94.9. I do want to thank Dr. Magnanti yet again. We'll see you back here next week.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.